copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Okay, in the second session, we're going to be looking at Martin Luther and his conversion. In order to understand that, though, we have to recognize that the Reformation is occurring in a particular historical context, and there are events that are outside of the realm of what we would normally consider church history that create the opportunities for people like Luther to emerge as thought leaders in the world. And the key one here is, interestingly enough, the invention of the suction pump. The suction pump was invented in the middle of the 1400s as a way of pumping water out of mines. See, the problem is, a mine is essentially a big hole in the ground, and basically whenever you dig far enough, you hit water. And so the big problem was mines flooding. Well, they discovered that, once they invented the suction pump, it allowed them to pump water out of the mines, which allowed them to go deeper. It allowed them to tunnel further. And this resulted in Central Europe in a massive silver boom. They were able to produce a lot of silver out of these mines. And the silver boom, then, is going to make certain areas in Germany very, very wealthy. We can talk about the Fugger Bank, which emerges as the largest bank in Europe, centered in Augsburg, on money from silver. We can also look at Saxony. The territory of Saxony in Germany was run, well, the one that we're most interested in, there were two parts of Saxony, the one we're most interested in was run by an officer known as the Elector. And the Elector in this period was Elector Frederick, known as Frederick the Wise. His dates are 1463 to 1525. The silver boom made Frederick the Wise very, very wealthy. As a matter of fact, for a while, his wealth actually rivaled that of the Habsburg family, which was clearly the most powerful political family in Central Europe. He used his wealth from all of the mining to do two things in particular that are interesting for us. The first is he created a very, very large collection of relics, one of the largest private collections in Europe. He housed this in his castle in his city of Wittenberg, and people would go on pilgrimage to view the relics. If I remember right, there was something like 19,000 of them. And visiting the relic collection, going on a pilgrimage to it, could take thousands of years off your time in purgatory. More on that later. The other thing he did with his money is he founded a university in his capital city, which was the University of Wittenberg. Now, this was the best that money could buy. It had all of the subjects that would normally be taught in the universities and some of the ones that weren't in all universities. He still managed to get them in to his university, and he bought the best professors he could with his wealth. In particular, he had a theological faculty there, and this is an unusual theological faculty because in most cases, schools would only have one style, if you will, of theology. There are multiple approaches to theology within Catholicism. You have particularly the major division is between the realists and the nominalists. And the schools would usually be one or the other. At Wittenberg, he actually had faculty that taught both. Okay, so it was very diverse faculty theologically. That's going to become important as we look at Luther's career. Now, the silver boom didn't only affect people like Frederick the Wise. It also had an effect on people at the local level, your workers, the people who work in the mines. They were also prospering during this period. And in particular, the Luther family was one that made a good living off of mining. Hans Luther, Martin Luther's father, was a mining engineer, basically, and he earned enough money from the mines to send his son Martin off to school. His goal was to have Martin become a lawyer because he saw law as a way of keeping Luther. Luther was a smart kid. He was brilliant, really. It was a way of keeping him out of the mines so that he didn't have to do the kind of work Hans had done. And instead, he'd be able to earn a good living in law and, again, enhance family prestige. So that was the goal, and he sent Luther to school at the University of Erfurt, not too far from Wittenberg. All of this changed, however, when Martin was coming home one day during it turns out an enormous thunderstorm broke out while he was on his way home. And this was one of these really bad ones where there are lightning bolts coming down and hitting the ground and everything else. One of them hit close enough to Luther that it literally knocked him to the ground. Apparently, he was riding a horse at the time, too, which, you know, it's quite a fall. He hit the ground. Now, he was convinced at this point that these were just sort of ranging shots and that the next one was going to hit him, that God was after him. And so he did what any self-respecting person in the period would have done. He started praying. You know, the old idea, there are no atheists in foxholes. He actually called on St. Anne. St. Anne was the patron saint of mining, which was the family occupation, so she was a logical person for him to call upon. And he said, "St. Anne, save me, I will become a monk." Now, monks, like I said last time, had a very bad reputation in this period, but still, it was believed that if you were serious about spirituality, being a monk and being a faithful monk was still the high point of this. The most spiritual people out there were the monks who actually kept their vows. This was kind of the attitude. Of course, they also said most monks don't. Basically, what he was doing was trying to bribe St. Anne. "St. Anne, save me, and I promise I'll be a good boy. I'll join a monastery. I'll do anything." Well, it turns out that Luther didn't die in this thunderstorm. And he got up, got back on his horse, and rode home and was thinking about what had just happened. Luther had a very good legal mind, even at this point, prior to any legal training. As a matter of fact, there are people who say that had Luther not gone into theology, he would still be remembered in legal history because his mind was really that good. And as he thought about this, he realized that that panicked prayer that he gave, "St. Anne, save me, I will become a monk," was the equivalent of a vow, and vows were unbreakable. So he got home and he told his father, "Dad, slight change of plans here. I was in this thunderstorm, I nearly got killed. I called on St. Anne to save me. She did, but I promised her I'd become a monk. So I'm going to have to give up law and join the monastery." His father was really upset about this, very, very angry, but he couldn't do anything about it. And so Luther ended up joining an Augustinian convent in Erfurt. Now, when he started off, he was, generally speaking, a sort of normal monk doing all the usual monkey things. But as time went on, he began having some real issues. Put simply, he started having massive problems with guilt. He would literally spend hours in the confessional with his confessor, Johann Staupitz, spending time racking his mind, talking about things, literally hours every day. It finally got to the point where Staupitz said to him, "Martin, you have not confessed anything even remotely interesting in weeks. Go away and don't come back until you do something worth confessing." That's pretty impressive that you get that kind of reaction, because Staupitz was one of these very, very serious thinkers and very, very serious about the faith, interested in reform of the church and everything else. Now, why did Luther do this? What caused this breakdown from Luther? I would argue it's probably past the level of neurosis into psychosis in terms of the level of mental breakdown he's got. R.C. Sproul suggests that the reason was Luther's legal mind. What is the greatest commandment? Well, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Okay? If that's the greatest commandment, what is the greatest sin? Put the word "not" there. It is not loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That is the greatest sin. It's a violation of the greatest commandment. Well, let's try this out. Your heart. Let's just keep it simple and say your heart is your affections. Are all your affections wrapped up in the love of God? Luther looked at this and had to answer no. Not all of my affections are wrapped up in the love of God. In fact, most of my affections are not wrapped up in the love of God. I love all kinds of other things. That's bad. Your soul, let's call that your will. Is every act of will that you do, every decision that you make, every action you take, is that based on the love of God? Luther had to say no. Your mind, are all your thoughts wrapped up in the love of God? Luther had to answer no. Your strength, what you do with your body, Is that wrapped up in the love of God? How about that last breath you just took? Did you take that for the love of God? No. So Luther looked at this and basically said, everything I do, everything I think, everything I feel is a mortal sin. It's a violation of the greatest commandment. And as someone who took this seriously, and this is, like I said, this is his legal mind at work, as someone who took this seriously, this drove him into absolute despair. And he could not find a way to escape this. Staupitz tried to help him. He acted as his confessor, as I said. He sent him on a trip to Rome. The monastery needed to send a number of people to Rome on an embassy to the Pope. Staupitz pulled some strings and got Luther to go along. A lot of people didn't think Luther was a good choice. He shouldn't have gone. But Staupitz thought, maybe in Rome he'll find what it is that he was looking for. Well, when he got to Rome, he discovered that Rome was not at all what he expected. He would go to these shrines, these relic sites and things like that, and want to pray there, and they would just push him through. Okay, you've been here, you've got your years off purgatory, keep moving. We've got to keep the line moving. He did all the different kinds of devotional work that he could in Rome and discovered all of it was simply a money-making opportunity for the Pope. He discovered brothels in Rome that specialized in servicing only the clergy. He talked about cardinals in Rome who were accounted living saints because they confined their sexual activities to adult women. He was just absolutely appalled by what he found there. And he came back to Germany, if anything, even more unsettled than he left. Now, Staupitz, for his part, did his best to try to help Luther work these things through. He encourages Luther, actually, to go to Wittenberg, where there's a position open, to start teaching theology. And Staupitz will actually arrange for Luther to go there. He wants Luther to study theology. He wants Luther to study the New Testament in the hopes that somehow in the midst of this, Staupitz saw real potential in Luther. He's a man of serious faith. He's got some issues, but he's a man of serious faith. And if we can get him to resolve these issues, he believed that Luther could be a major voice for change and reform in the church. And so he encourages him to study theology and sends him off to the University of Wittenberg to be a bachelor lecturer in theology while he works on completing his degree. Now, while in Wittenberg, we don't really know the date of this, but Luther had something that he referred to as his tower experience while he was there. And again, the exact content of this tower experience is not as clear as we would like it to be. But we know that it resulted in a transformation of his life. I have a friend who has a theory that this was prompted actually by Erasmus's Greek translation of the New Testament, which would date it to probably around 1515, 1516. The argument goes like this. If you look at the phrase, we know that one of the things that Luther talked about is the concept of the righteousness of God. Now, in Latin, the phrase righteousness of God, the of God is a genitive case. And in Latin, it just simply means it's just a possessive. So what this would mean then is that the righteousness of God is God's righteousness that he is demanding from us, that we perform up to his standards of righteousness. If you go to Greek, however, the phrase righteousness of God is still a genitive case. In Greek, the genitive can mean source. So it's not so much God's righteousness that's a characteristic of him, but rather it's righteousness whose source is from God himself. What that would mean then is reading the text in Greek, studying the text in Greek, what Luther could have seen at this point, again, we don't know for sure if this is what happened, but it's consistent at least with what we know of Luther. What would happen here is that Luther would realize that righteousness wasn't something that God demanded of us, but rather something that God gave to us. God recognizes human failings. He recognizes human frailty. He recognizes the fact that we sin. But he still loves us enough to want to have a relationship with us, to want us to be part of his people. And as a result, what we are incapable of doing ourselves, God does for us. We cannot produce righteousness, so God gives us righteousness. And he realized at this point that the way that this would operate from studying the text is that this righteousness comes to us purely and solely by our faith, by trusting in God. We get what we trust. If we trust ourselves, we get what we deserve. If we trust Christ, we get Christ's merits and his salvation, his righteousness, and all that gets transferred to us. So at this point, Luther was transformed. He was a man completely transformed because all of the problems with guilt, all of the psychological issues and everything else that he had in terms of trying to understand his relationship with God and his dealings with God, all of these things went away. Luther was asked at one point, "Do you love God?" His reply was, "Love him. Sometimes I hate him." Because he saw that, you know, again, originally he saw God as this uncompromising, unforgiving deity. And now suddenly he has a totally different vision of who God is and who he is. And like I said, all the psychological problems and everything else vanish at this point. And Luther then begins to approach theology in a totally new way. For Luther, the concept of justification by faith alone, by the grace of God alone, that concept becomes the core of theology. And he goes to the New Testament text, he goes even to the Old Testament text, and he reads the whole thing through the lens of salvation through Christ by grace through faith. It leads him to, it literally transforms his entire approach to theology. And what emerges is something that was initially called the New Theology or the Wittenberg Theology. Everything is shaped by that cardinal doctrine. Now, Luther taught this to his students. He got his doctorate of theology. He begins teaching this to his students. And in this period, the standard academic exercise that everyone did was debates. You were graded on the basis of debates. There were no exams, there were no term papers, nothing like that. You did debates. The faculty even did debates. That was what academics was about. It was about debating. Just like today, I assign term papers to my students, but I give papers at conferences. There, you assign debates to the students and you do debates yourself. Luther's students would enter debates with the other students in the theology faculties, the realists, the nominalists, all of them. And Luther's students were so well trained by Luther that they demolished the opposition in debate after debate after debate. They were so effective in their debates that not only did they convince the other students that Luther was right, they convinced the other faculty members that Luther was right. So the entire faculty at the University of Wittenberg converts from the Thomists who had followed Thomas Aquinas as a realist, from the followers of Gabriel Biel, the nominalist. All of these people, they abandon what they were trained as themselves and adopt Luther's approach to theology. And they do it because Luther's students were so good at what they do. I don't know if you are in the academic world enough to understand how utterly remarkable that is. But the fact of the matter is students never convince faculty of anything, except in Luther's case they did. So what emerges here is, as far as Luther is concerned, what Luther is thinking, I have found a new key to theology, a new way of understanding the Bible, a new way of understanding the Old Testament, a new way of understanding the New Testament. This revolutionizes and transforms all of theology top to bottom. It revolutionizes practice, it revolutionizes everything. And what's more, it is a good, faithful, Catholic approach to theology. Luther had no intention of breaking with Rome. He did not think that what he did would necessitate a break with Rome. In the Middle Ages, into the early modern period, there were all different approaches to theology that were accepted in the Catholic Church. You had various mystical approaches, you had various nominalist approaches, you had various surrealist approaches. All these different approaches were out there. As far as Luther was concerned, he's just come up with a new and better approach to theology that should be able to fit right into the Catholic Church and Catholic theology. What he hadn't thought through yet, although he will, what he hadn't thought through yet was the implications of his theology for a wide swath of things within the Catholic Church. He won't think those things through until the aftermath of the indulgence controversy, when Catholic polemicists arguing against him force him to think those things through. But initially, this is just a reform program in the Catholic Church as far as he's concerned.